match made in hell. While back in March, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission clammed up about what was going on at nuclear reactors that were going through refueling in the middle of a pandemic, a loose coalition of nuclear organizations and activists have been putting together a warning for Congress to step in because, among other problems,
one of the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's responses to COVID is to allow utilities to get exemptions to certain kinds of maintenance procedures that have to take place, kind of wait out the COVID and kick the maintenance can down the road. That can have serious and very dire safety implications if you do that with the wrong piece of maintenance or the wrong piece of safety protocol at your plant.
Well, if the NRC is COVID kicking its maintenance and repair work down the road, you don't have to live anywhere near a nuclear reactor to be affected if something goes wrong, and reminds you too late that you are smack dab in the middle of that life-threatening, terminally uncomfortable seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevy. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, two interviews. First, a COVID-19 nuclear update from Dave Kraft of Nuclear Energy Information Service, NEIS. This is based on the findings of a six-month examination of COVID-19 dangers posed by nuclear reactors, especially during refueling, and a new push to create congressional oversight of the nuclear industry's pandemic response. And we will also have advance word on a new film, little talked about event in nuclear history from 100 years ago, the Radium Girls, watch dial painters who licked brushes covered in radioactive luminous paint to better paint the numbers on watch dials for soldiers. We'll talk with Radium Girls director-producer Lydia Dean Pilcher and director-writer Ginny Moeller about the film, which becomes available online and in theaters this week. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than is showing up on last-ditch political ads on TV. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, October 20th, 2020, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out with a piece of good news, the Pacific Island nation of Tuvalu ratified the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons on October 12th, becoming the 47th nation in the world to do so. Only three more notifications are now needed to bring this crucial treaty into force. A group of U.S.-based activists, including Beyond Nuclear, Nuclear Information and Resource Service, or NIRS, NEIS from Chicago, and Coalition for Nuclear-Free Great Lakes have been monitoring the COVID-19 nuclear connection and working hard to tease out the kinds of statistics and issues that the nuclear industry is loath to make public. They pulled together the information into a press release, and it has been sent to members of Congress and the news media. That release of information came today, Tuesday, October 20th, and today is when we spoke with one of the group's members, Dave Kraft of Nuclear Energy Information Service, or NEIS, in Chicago, about its contents. Dave Kraft, always great to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks. Good to be back.
You have been part of a coalition task force on COVID issues at nuclear power plants, which just issued a major press release. First of all, what was this coalition? What is this coalition? And give us a sense of who has been involved with it.
It's not a coalition in a formal sense. You know, there are no contracts or anything. But back in March and April, a number of organizations, safe energy groups around the country, were noticing that nuclear reactors were engaging in maintenance operations associated with their fueling outages, which take place every 18 months, roughly. At the same time, when the COVID virus was beginning to work its way across the country. So organizations on their own were just noticing and being quite alarmed with the possibility that as the nation was going into lockdown and into various forms of isolation, sequestration, suddenly 800 to 1,200 workers from all over the country were showing up at their reactor sites to do maintenance and refueling. That's not a way to contain a pandemic. So independently, we all just kind of came together and started weekly phone calls to check in with each other. And we were finding that around the country at various reactor sites, there were some serious conditions that were emerging. On top of that, while we did see action on the part of the regulators, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in particular, when we attended the NRC's webinars online about their reactions to COVID, we were coming away with no answers. We were, at least not to the questions that were important to us. So while the NRC was addressing the issue, we don't know that they were totally solving the problem in doing it. So this was really the push, the impetus for us getting together on a more regular basis and putting together recommendations on what we thought would be important, not just from the nuclear industry standpoint, but from the community's point of view and the community standpoint in dealing with a COVID epidemic, or excuse me, pandemic, context of operating nuclear reactors safely. Now, in Illinois, we have 11 operating reactors here, and we had quite a few of them that were slated for refueling outages, which means that they would also be doing maintenance. And we decided it was time to take this to a different level because we didn't seem to be getting the kind of response we wanted from NRC. So we started some dialogue with the staff members of Senator Durbin and Senator Duckworth on this issue because they're representing the most nuclear state in the country at a time when our governor, Governor Pritzker, was desperately trying to get everybody on board in the state to enact some form of sensible CDC guidelines on isolation, keeping social distancing, wearing masks, which you can't really do very well if you're bringing 1,200 people in from Alabama, Mississippi, and New Jersey, you know, to do work. So there was this glaring horns of the dilemma kind of situation that has emerged, which has really forced us to come together and start talking about this issue as a national coalition of organizations.
Nuclear Hot Seat started covering the COVID nuclear connection back in February, and it was in March that suddenly the NRC said, we're not going to be reporting on our statistics anymore. So there are certain statistics that you have listed in this report, but they all seem old. How current are they and how do you get your numbers?
Excellent question. And that's kind of the crux of the problem we've had with NRC. It's almost a Trump version of, if you don't test for COVID, it'll go away. You won't have the numbers going up. And NRC has a sort of parallel track going of, oh, it's not our responsibility to keep track of how many COVID cases are at each reactor. That's OSHA's job. At the same time, we challenge them in their webinars of, well, then how can you really determine if an outage is going safely if you don't know how many people are exposed or how many are positives or how many are in the hospital? Now, in the case that we've heard, one death at Fermi in Detroit, outside of Detroit, Michigan. The NRC doesn't track that. So that's one example of the holes that we were seeing, which we think are sound, not just nuclear operation, but sound public health operation. Because we have to realize that these outages are a two-way conduit. It's not just what happens within the confines of the reactor site that should be NRC's concern. It's the fact that those workers who are coming in and eventually going out, maybe going to other reactor sites to work, may be positives. We don't know. Who's tracking that? Maybe eating at the restaurants down the street or staying at the local Holiday Inn or Motor Lodge or campsite. What community services are being used that are being affected by workers who are doing work at the reactor sites? How are the largely rural, if not small town, medical infrastructures able to handle any kind of an outbreak that would happen? These are huge implications, not just for the operation of the reactor, but for the community as well. And we think the NRC and the other federal agencies like OSHA have an obligation to be, number one, more transparent about exposure rates, positives, negatives, but also we need to have an ongoing database that is accessible at a moment's notice, because these workers are transient. They're highly specialized, highly trained workers to do very specific tasks of reactor maintenance, and they're going to go from site to site around the country depending on their contracts. We have to know in advance if they are testing positive at site A before they get to site B and site C. That's the kind of thing that we're pushing for, that it, you have to expand the notion here of what constitutes legitimate reactor safety implications. And for us, this is a fitness for duty issue, and NRC needs to take it in that regards. To actually answer the question of how many, where do the numbers come from, how old are they, that's part of the problem. Because nobody tracks it, NRC doesn't let us know. It's been our job to rifle through newspaper accounts from all over the country, ask organizations that are near reactors to provide numbers to us. So we can't say if these numbers are actually valid at this point in time, or that your listeners listening to this show. Some of these numbers we acknowledge are from back in the springtime or early summer. Some are recent. But that's part of the problem. Nobody really knows. And it's that ignorance which parallels the Trump ignorance on COVID very precisely.
It's my understanding that refueling happens in seasons, that there's a spring season, they stop for the summer, and then they pick up again in the fall. Has that reconnection with the refueling process started to take hold, and is that in effect now?
It's not as seasonal as you make it out to be. Refueling takes place when needed, and it usually occurs every 18 months. I'm hearing some reactors are pushing it to 24. They're using high burn-up fuel, things like that. But you can figure 18 months to 2 years, every reactor has to go down. We do have a list of reactors for this year, which we obtained from the Nuclear Energy Institute in a trade press article, because the NRC wouldn't tell us, which is also interesting. So the pattern we were seeing is it can happen anytime, and it did occur throughout the entire year so far. There's still a sprinkling of outages that are going to occur probably through the beginning of November, but then there's nothing after that we see is scheduled for this year.
In this press release, which was just released today, October 20th, Tuesday, you have an extensive two-page list of concerns regarding COVID at nuclear reactors, workplace safety, community safety, and regulatory response concerns.
Right.
Give us some highlights from that. And what is the ask? What is this group of concerned safe energy groups asking for safety to be instituted?
The three broad stroke requests that we put out here, it actually goes to public officials. The targets for our press release were largely the governors of the states who are trying to contain the pandemic, and the federal delegations to Congress who have some authority over the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, OSHA, and the other agencies. Those were the targets for three broad recommendations. We want the Congress and the federal agencies to acknowledge the fact that public health is a state jurisdiction. It is not necessarily a federal one, and that the states should have latitude to set their own standards, requirements, issue orders for how to deal with the pandemic, how to keep isolation, and that the two should cooperate on this. It should be a cooperative effort. So what we're trying to get across is that states and feds need to cooperate, but according to states' rights, they should have the jurisdiction to call the shots on how they're going to deal with the pandemic safely in their state. The second broad stroke is to call for oversight. We want the House and Senate energy committees and committees dealing with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to, number one, take a look at the two pages of recommendations that we put out, discuss those, and perhaps convene hearings in Congress on how best to deal with nuclear power plant operation during a pandemic. Because as we point out in the release, today it's COVID-19. But if you take some of the predictions on climate change to heart, there's a possibility that in the future there are going to be other kinds of viral or bacterial releases or pandemics, epidemics, that will have a similar effect on nuclear plant operations. It's better to deal with it now, get the best practices in place before it becomes a problem, than dealing with it as a crisis. And the last broad stroke that we're asking, and again, we're leaning on the House and Senate to do this, is to really leverage their power over federal agencies like the NRC and OSHA, and really require them to follow the regulations that are in place. Because one of the things we did find is that one of the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's responses to COVID, is to allow utilities to get exemptions to certain kinds of maintenance procedures that have to take place. You know, kind of wait out the COVID and kick the maintenance can down the road. That can have serious and very dire safety implications if you do that with the wrong piece of maintenance or the wrong piece of safety protocol at your plant. We saw that with Davis Bessie back in 2002, which almost blew its pressure vessel top when the NRC allowed that utility to defer maintenance. So that's the horn of the dilemma in an operating nuclear power under a pandemic situation, is you either try to curtail the pandemic spread by not bringing the workers in to do the maintenance, running the risk that something will go wrong, or you do the maintenance and run the risk of spreading the pandemic. And this is something that requires federal discussion and certainly oversight of the agencies from Congress.
Today's press release is a marker. It's obviously something that the group has worked long and hard on. From this point forward, what will your actions be? And is there some way that the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat might be able to assist you?
Yes, and thanks for that offer. As I've said earlier, we've been in some discussions now for about 2 months with the staffs of Senators Durbin and Duckworth here in Illinois. And we have provided these 2 pages of recommendations to them as sort of a basis to kick things in motion. We would expect them to go back to their colleagues in Congress and raise this as issues. And as we had suggested earlier, we would really like to see some congressional hearings on this or some sort of oversight of the federal agencies. So the 2 pages of best practice recommendations will be available to anyone who wants them, that they can take those to their congressional delegations in their state and say, look, we have either an actual problem because we have reactors here, or a potential one if we're going to do maintenance and refueling at a later date, and we need some congressional action on this now. So these will be posted. I have to check in with colleagues at NEARS and Beyond Nuclear to see if they're going to be up on their website, but we can certainly make them available and send them by email to people. If you want to contact NEIS, it's very simple, neis@neis.org, and we'll be happy to share these recommendations with anyone who asks for them.
We will, of course, link to it on Nuclear Hot Seat as well so that people can download it directly from our site. Thanks to you, everybody else who worked on this. I've been a lurker around the edges of your emails, but I haven't been able to jump in on it. So it's great to have this information. Congratulations on reaching this point, and here's hoping you have further success.
Well, thank you. And I want to acknowledge our colleagues at NEARS, Tim Judson in particular, and at Beyond Nuclear, we have Paul Gunter, Eric Epstein from TMI Alert, Mike Keegan in Michigan, and several other folks from reactor communities. So thank you all for your help to make this possible.
That was Dave Kraft of NEIS, based in Chicago, one of a group of national activists filling us in on the latest about the COVID nuclear connection and today's release of information to Congress and the news media. We will link to the release on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, number 487. In other news this week, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has once again given irresponsible waivers to utility to not do essential inspection of a damaged nuclear reactor. In this case, the Donald C. Cook twin reactors on the east coast of Lake Michigan, 70 miles east of Chicago. In Southern California, Public Watchdogs has filed a new petition to the NRC regarding the failed and shuttered San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station. While the NRC states that Holtec, the company that makes the thin-walled stainless steel nuclear waste containers that are used at San Onofre, has claimed that the canisters can never crack open, Owner Southern California Edison has never provided documentation proving that the canisters won't leak, and the NRC has failed to provide evidence of analyses or tests that ascertain the integrity of the cask containing the nuclear waste. The waste is buried in 5/8-inch thin nuclear canisters, only 108 from high tide of the Pacific Ocean, and in the middle of 8 million people. Government watchdog group Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board announced that the Los Alamos National Laboratory is storing hundreds, maybe thousands of barrels of radioactive waste mixed with incompatible chemicals that have the potential to cause an explosion, putting workers and the public at risk. A new study released by Harvard University scientists shows that the radioactivity of airborne particles increases significantly downwind of fracking sites in the United States. And elsewhere, I would presume. The scientists said this could damage the health of people living in nearby communities and that further research was needed to understand how to stop the release of the radioactive elements from under the ground. It's simple. Don't dig them up. Leave it in the ground. And now...
Nuclear hot seat. Nuclear hot seat. Nuclear hot seat. None that's out of week.
The Environmental Non-Protection Agency has announced that it will allow what it is calling limited use of a radioactive byproduct of phosphate mining to be used in the building of roads. Isn't that special? 1 billion tons of the solid substance, phosphogypsum, is piled high in mounds called stacks throughout Florida. The spokesmodel for the Florida Industrial and Phosphate Research Institute said of radiation, it's low level. And we all know how dangerous low-level radiation can be if you listen to this show with any frequency. The Fertilizer Institute, a group which calls itself the voice of the fertilizer industry, so many opportunities here for non-broadcast-worthy puns, but I will restrain myself. The Fertilizer Institute actually got the EPA to say that, in making its determination, reusing the substance for roads is no riskier than keeping it in a stack. Except, the stacks are monitored, separated from homes, schools, people, children, pregnant women, women who want to get pregnant, men who would like to have a sperm count, and so many others. And that's just a short list of the possible repercussions from exposure to low-level radiation. And that is why not only Fertilizer Institute, but the Environmental Non-Protection Agency. You are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of week.
The Energy Department has approved a $1.4 billion grant to help defray costs for a group of utilities in Utah that are the first in line to buy power from the reactors produced by NuScale Power. These are the unproven, not yet built, so-called small modular nuclear reactors that NuScale and other companies have been pushing as the solution to climate change when nobody knows whether they will work, how well they will work, how long it will take for them to be built, and whether their claims about the technology are true. The Utah Associated Municipal Power Systems, or UAMPS, a group of small community-owned utilities in 6 western states, had previously indicated the group might pull out of the NuScale project unless it received the extra funding from the government. And they got it. Sorta. Pending congressional approval. To be continued. In Japan, the government has finally announced that, yes, they are planning to dump more than 1 million tons of radioactive water from the Fukushima nuclear plant wreckage into the, I love how they call it the sea, it's the Pacific Ocean. This despite strong opposition from environmentalists, local fishermen, farmers, and the government of South Korea, which issued a statement through their foreign ministry stating that its foremost priority is to protect its citizens' health and safety in dealing with Japan's potential discharge of contaminated water from the wreckage of the Fukushima nuclear plant. Poland has made a deal with the United States for $18 billion to purchase what they think is going to be 6 nuclear reactors made by Westinghouse. But as Paul Gunter of Beyond Nuclear said, with Westinghouse leading the negotiations, it's more likely than not that $18 billion won't get one Westinghouse AP1000 completed. and certainly it won't be finished by 2033, as now projected, if at all. And from Canada, why is that country's federal government funding new nuclear power reactors? We'll have a link up on the website to an article that shows that there is no evidence that nuclear power will achieve carbon reduction targets, while there is considerable research showing just the opposite. More on climate change and nukes on next week's show. We'll have this week's second featured interview in just a moment. But first, there are so many issues begging for our attention and involvement these days. COVID-19, the U.S. presidential election, global warming-influenced wildfires, ice melt and extreme weather events, international warmongering, and I'm sure you've got your own personal list of issues that are making demands for your time, attention, pulling at your heart and soul, interrupting your sleep. It's hard to know where to pay attention now, and nuclear is rarely at the top of that list. But you are a hearty lot listening to this, and you understand that nuclear deserves to be at the top of any list, because bombs around the world are on hair trigger alert, reactors leak deadly radioactivity, there's no plan for long-term radioactive waste storage, and no site polluted with radiation has ever been completely cleaned up. That puts all of us at risk. And that is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We know where to look for the nuclear story. We know the questions to ask so we can report on the ongoing, evolving nuclear truth that the industry would rather we not hear about, let alone understand. And let's face it, mainstream reporters don't know how to ask the right questions. That's why the time would be right now to help us out and support us with a donation. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button. That's where you can help us with a donation of any size. And that same red button is now where you can set up a monthly $5, same as a cup of coffee and a nice tip here in the U.S. Please, if you care about nuclear issues, do what you can now. And know that however much you can help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. The discovery of radium by Marie Curie set off a cottage industry of radium-based products and cures, so-called cures, by entrepreneurs convinced of its miraculous industrial and health benefits. The dangers of exposure to radioactivity were not yet known, and this new element was perceived to be harmless, if not advantageous. But then one case, one use of this uranium derivative was exposed for what it was, the reckless, toxic endangerment of workers at a watch-dial painting factory. They were all young women, eager for a good job, and they were instructed to put radium paint on their brushes, then run the brushes through their lips to get a really good point on it, and then paint the dials. A new movie, not a documentary, a dramatic film, tells this story. Radium Girls is set in 1925 and features two young sisters who worked at American Radium Factory painting glow-in-the-dark watch dials with radioactive paint. It's a story of dreams, loss of innocence, female empowerment, and the emerging awareness of the deadly toxic nature of the work they were engaged in and the horrific health damage done by their work. It also features, of course, the corporate cover-up. It's a modern tale set about 100 years ago, and I'm pleased to introduce you not only to the film, but to producer-director Lydia Dean Pilcher and writer-director Ginny Moeller. Radium Girls is being released on October 23rd, and we spoke about it on Wednesday, October 7, 2020. Lydia Dean Pilcher and Ginny Moeller, thank you so much for joining us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you for having us.
Great to be here.
First of all, I want to tell you that I really enjoyed this movie, and I think it's an important one, not only for people who are into the nuclear issue, but also filmgoers in general. As we get started, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about your background so we can get a sense of who it is we're talking with. Lydia, let's start with you.
I have spent most of my career being a producer, and I have a company in New York, Cine Mosaic, which has really developed independent films, a lot of female perspective storytelling, and I had begun early on as a documentarian, and it was a real opportunity to work with Ginny on Radium Girls when we decided to team up and do this together.
And Ginny, what's your background?
I studied film at NYU Tisch School of the Arts, focusing on screenwriting and cinematography, actually. But then after school, I found my way into the documentary filmmaking world and just sort of happened to get a job as an archival researcher. I didn't know much about what that was, but soon was immersed in primary source documents and images that I had never seen before and really connecting with a history that I hadn't known about, specifically untold stories of women like the Radium Girls.
You're the one who first came in contact with the story, the history of the Radium Girls. What did you find? How did you find it? And what was your response when you did?
One of my first documentary jobs, I was reading the Leslie Groves memoir, Now It Can Be Told, which is his version, his experience during the Manhattan Project and really technically how they made it happen. And there is a line in a section about health insurance for the Manhattan Project workers. And he said, "We all remembered the tragic dial painters of World War I." And this was about how they knew that the workers needed to be protected. And my first thought was, what is a dial painter? What tragedy? You know, what happened? What is he talking about? And like, we all remembered. I don't remember. And so I Googled tragic dial painters, World War I. And one of the first things that came up was the Wikipedia page on the Radium Girls. And I think my next thought was, I can't believe I've never heard this story before. And why isn't this a movie? And that was the beginning.
Lydia, how did you first become aware of what Ginny had discovered and what led you to believe that this was going to make a good movie?
Well, I've been an environmental activist for a long time in my life and had been really looking for ways to merge my activist interests with my storytelling career. And I had really basically been put the word out everywhere that I wanted to do a project that dealt with climate change or environmental justice. I was wide open, but that's the only thing I was looking for. And people were sending me things, and it really wasn't until I got Ginny and Brittany's script, which a friend had connected us, Ginny and Brittany Shaw, who co-wrote it with Ginny. I was enchanted by the voices of these teenage girls, Bessie and Joe. They had big dreams, but very different dreams. Bessie wanted to become a movie star and go to Hollywood, and Josephine wanted to go to Egypt and conduct archaeological digs. And these girls were sisters working in the factory, hoping for the moment when they would be able to leave Orange, New Jersey for a bigger landscape to live their lives on. And then this rude awakening begins to happen, which is essentially a coming of age for these girls. And the setting of telling the Radium Girls story in that world was exciting.
Now, you received a finished script, or at least according to that draft, the finished script. Ginny, how did you approach the writing of the script, and how did you get together with your writing partner on this?
My writing partner, Brittany Shaw, she and I were actually working at the same boutique documentary film company at the time. And so all I had to do was swivel my chair over and say, "Have you seen this story? We should write a movie." And we also knew that the Alfred P. Sloan NYU production grant had a deadline coming up. The grant was $100,000 to make your first feature film, providing that it would have to be science focused. And we said, this story is inherently science focused. It's at the heart of what's going on here is scientific research and covering up research and not understanding whether an element is dangerous and long-term testing, all of this. So I think the application was maybe a month away, and all we had to do is write a one-page summary of what our screenplay would be. That's when we first discovered Bessie and Joe and the sisters and thought about how we would adapt the true story into a fictional world. What's pretty magical was from there on, we kept advancing to the next round of this grant. And it was a really amazing way to write a first screenplay because we were both working full time, but the grant gave us these milestones to hit. So the next was a 5-page treatment and then a step outline of the script and then a first draft of the script. And with each round, we got closer and closer to being a finalist. And then about a year and a half later, we were so lucky to win that prize of the $100,000 grant. And it was at that point that we had, I think at that point, it was a third draft of the script. And that's when we connected with Lydia.
Were you connected with Lydia because of the award? Did you find her on your own?
You know, it's actually a funny story. The summer before winning the grant, I was working on a film shoot in New Mexico and had decided to stay out in New Mexico and work on a film about the Manhattan Project. And one of the people I was set to start working with is an old friend and colleague of Lydia's. And even though that movie ended up not going forward, I stayed in touch with that person and she put us in touch with Lydia. And so I think Lydia probably has another side of that encounter.
Lydia, you want to jump in here?
You know what, I'd like to sort of thread it forward, because I think that when I read the screenplay, which I loved and was so engaged in my conversations with Brittany and Jenny about it, we still underwent a process as time will have, you know, went on for a few years just to develop it into something that we could take on screen and convey the scope, I think, of what the story deserved. And it was interesting that Jenny and Brittany were both archival footage researchers, because I was very, and we all had a documentary, you know, background. So I was very interested in the idea of how we could weave the narrative in a way that we could take advantage of real archival footage to convey sort of world-building elements of the Radium Girl story that we might not have otherwise, you know, been able to afford to do. So Jimmy and Brittany had written a character, Etta, who had had sort of varying degrees of presence in the film. But when we decided to give her a career as a photojournalist who was from Tulsa, Oklahoma, it brought a whole opening of being able to see the larger world through Etta's camera. And I believe Brittany had been working on a documentary with the History Channel about civil rights. So she had just come across the story of Tulsa, Oklahoma for the first time. So it was really, it was very, a very interesting organic process of weaving different elements of the world and bringing them to the Radium Girl story in a narrative.
That was one of the things that I found very enriching about it. And I'm wondering, was there a specific reason why you did not go with the real characters, but as you were very clear about stating in the film, these are composites that you created? Jenny, do you want to take that one?
The way that Brittany and I had first conceived the story was about teenage girls with big dreams, like Lydia said, different dreams, and what happens when their world is turned upside down. And I think for myself as a screenwriter, to really honor the true stories meant that there are a lot of question marks. And to be able to take that creative license by creating characters inspired by and based on the true characters and composites and different elements from different people let me feel like we could really explore their like deepest dreams and wants with freedom and still honor the original story and not say this is who they were and what happened, but this is who they could have been.
So Lydia, you have the script in good shape, good form. Did you have to shop it around? Because you certainly have an impressive list of the executive producers on this, Lily Tomlin, Jane Wagner. How did they become involved, or were you already involved with them and they just picked up on it?
No, we definitely had set out to finance the Radium Girl story. I think it's interesting in financing female stories because the people who are the most interested are women. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to get a number of grant supports. It was always meant to be a smaller budgeted movie. We found a group of equity investors who worked in Broadway, and Lily was part of that group, and they really all read the script, just loved it. They saw what I saw, and they came forward and really helped us finish what we needed to get it up on the screen.
Another of your executive producers is Willette Klausner, and she's actually somebody I did work with on her musical, one that she produced called Twist, based on Oliver Twist. How did Willette become involved? Was she part of this Broadway group, and what was her role?
Willette was definitely part of the Broadway group of investors. And they also, you know, they're involved in all kinds of creative and financial endeavors. But she was very much shoulder to shoulder with the other women. And it was just terrific to have them on our team and supporting us all the way.
We've talked a lot about what it took to actually take the film and move it forward. Give the listeners a sense, what is the story that you are telling in Radium Girls?
Radium Girls, the movie, is the story of two sisters who work as dial painters in a radium factory where they paint glow-in-the-dark watch dials. When Jo, one of the sisters, suddenly becomes ill from a mysterious disease, her sister Bessie goes on a quest to understand what's happening and discovers that radium is toxic and her sister has been poisoned, and incites some of the other factory workers to take the radium company to court to show that not only is radium poisonous, but the company knew that they were poisonous and knew that it was poisonous and covered it up, putting the workers in great harm.
And this is a true story.
It is a true story.
To amplify that, I would say that one of the things, as we sort of delved more into the research and our own development process, that one of the things that really attracted me was that the Radium Girls were part of the early women's political movement. Women had just gotten the right to vote. They wanted to use it. There were many women's consumer and social justice groups that were forming, many inspired by Jane Addams and Hull House. Catherine Wiley of the Consumers League in New Jersey is a character in the movie. And it really became apparent to me as we got deeper and deeper into the research that it was these women who had fought for political power for so many years who recognized the Radium Girls story. And they lifted that story up to a national level. And the timing, as always, was everything, because we were at the beginning of industrialization. There was no regulation in industry. Women were very concerned about that. Now that they had the right to vote, they wanted to put it to practice and really begin to make the workplace more regulated and a safer place to be.
It was a very rich experience, in part, not just because we have this narrative story about some young women who we really grow to care about, but because it is liberally woven through with the archival footage. I've certainly done a lot of research into a wide range of nuclear areas, but you had things that I had never seen in there. What were your sources, and how much of this did you know beforehand, and how much of it was just the hunt for the great picture, the great film clip?
I would say that our process of archival research was wide-ranging and exhaustive and pretty exhilarating. You know, I think as an archival researcher, you spend a lot of time combing through material, and then you'll stumble across something, like you said, that I had never seen before, I didn't know existed, and say, wow, like this is it. So I think, you know, the ratio of the amount of archival footage we looked at compared to what's in the film, I think we have a pretty healthy ratio there. And I think, you know, we have at least a dozen archival houses that we sourced from. I think we tried to be really creative and really open to the type of material that existed, and worked with some pretty incredible archival partners.
I've seen pictures of the real Radium Girls and what happened to them, and the physical deterioration is quite gruesome. I thought you were tasteful in the pieces that you chose to show, but also you didn't go full scale into the horror. How did you determine where to draw the line on that?
I think there's a balance that you always want to achieve when you're telling a story that is already horrific. And we wanted to indicate the severity of what the girls were going through. A lot of it really does come through just in the stories. And then toward the end, we have a letter writing sequence when other girls and other factories are writing to Bessie and Joey, thanking them for taking on the cause and standing up. And they begin to share some of the gruesome situations that they have found themselves in. So it was a time not unlike a little bit of the time that we're in right now, where not everything was known about radium. It was something that was killing people. Science was being called into question. Even Marie Curie had to come forward and acknowledge that while there were many positive benefits to radium in terms of reducing tumors and having a positive impact with cancer, that in fact, the body absorbs it like calcium. So if you're licking radium on a brush, it's going to go into your bones.
So it was at least admitted to in the era that it was dangerous. But yet, as you show, and as we've come to experience so often in modern times, the corporation, rather than acting responsibly, did everything it could to either suppress the story or to buy off the young women. Did you intentionally structure the story so that it parallels so much of what we know in modern times, or was this just something that grew out of the material because that's what it was?
Both. I think the material as it was parallels the corruption that we see today in an uncanny way. And I think that something that I find very powerful about the Radium Girls case and the sort of history of radioactivity is that it's so easy today it's so obvious that they were lying. It's so obvious that they are obfuscating and trying to strong arm these women into agreements when they know that it's dangerous. They know how deadly what they're doing is. But at the time, there was not that widespread understanding of the danger of radioactivity. And so for me, it's really helpful looking at today where you say, okay, well, like, what are the tactics that are happening when corporations are doing this? And where are they sowing doubt? Because in the 1920s, the radium companies did sow doubt. They put forward all sorts of research, with air quotes, research that said that it was safe. And what the Dow painters were ingesting was not harmful. They were sick for other reasons, things that continue to happen today. But today, that element of doubt is exploited. And so it's, for me, it's a crucial parallel.
There's certainly a long history of lies in the nuclear industry about what the impact is from radiation. And I'm actually writing something in connection with that right now about the man who wrote all the press releases and stories following the Manhattan Project. So when you mention Leslie Gross, I'm very familiar with that area. But the same lies are being told today about, radiation exposure, it's not that bad. In the making of this film, or in the move that you are making to release it later this month, have you had any kind of pushback from the nuclear industry or its representatives?
Not yet. It'll be interesting to see if that is coming forward as the publicity about our movie gets out there. I will say that the EPA, who deals with toxic chemical regulation on a daily basis, let us know that they still use the Radium Girls case, even in their arguments for toxic regulations today. And so there are a lot of themes and a lot of issues around the idea of research, who controls research. As one of our characters, Doris, says, owning research, that's like owning gravity. But in fact, we live in a world where everybody's not equal. And I think it's this inequality which is really gets to the heart of the matter. And when people value human lives differently, that's a crisis of humanity.
We're now in COVID times, which has already delayed the release of the film once. How are you releasing the film, and how might listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat be able to access it and see it?
Well, the film will be released in cinemas across the United States where cinemas are allowed to open with legal social distancing. At the same time, we're conducting a virtual cinema release. So October 23rd, the movie will be available everywhere. And you'll be able to Google onto our website, radiumgirlsmovie.com, and it will direct you to ways that you can either go to a cinema near you if there is one open, or you can buy a ticket online. And it's going to be available in that way through the beginning of 2021.
And what do you hope that people who view the movie will come away from it with?
Well, I think that their story of coming to a certain consciousness about something that was happening, believing that they could have power if they express their voice, having the courage to stand up to the corporation, having the courage to stand up for what they understood was true and right and for the good of all. That is the story that we need to hear today. Because I think in the pandemic, in this time when we've been forced to distance ourselves from each other, what we really need to do is to be able to find our ways to come together and support each other. So we hope that that's the message that people will take away from the film.
I mean, I think, yes, 100%. And what I would add to that is the experience that I've had in making this film over the past 8 years, coming into a new relationship with history and the way that we talk about history and the way that we understand what people have been through and what they've stood up to. And I think this is 100 years ago that we're talking about. And some of the archival you'll see in the film is protests against police brutality, the way that the workers are finding their voices and helping each other, and the structures, the advocacy that enable people to participate and to speak out. And I think for me, there's something very moving and inspiring about the fact that these stories are all around us. These stories go back a long time. And part of what is exciting to do is to find them. And so I hope someone watches this film and says, what else was happening then? What else was happening 100 years earlier? And where are the stories that I feel connected to?
It was a period piece, but a very modern story. And I certainly am looking forward to seeing it again. Is there anything that either one of you would like to add at this point?
I just wanted to mention that, you know, we become aware that there's a play being performed in high schools called Radium Girls, and it's been in the top 10 high school plays for the last 3 years. So many young girls have reached out to us just dying to see this movie. So this story really speaks to us about what the younger generation is experiencing and what they are seeking and what they are upholding. And so we're really excited for people of all ages to see the movie. But I think the ones who are going to actually really come forward and make a difference are the ones that are the age of Bessie and Joe. So that's what we're looking forward to.
It's really thrilling. And I'm so grateful to be able to share it with people now. It's been a long, long labor of love, and I've learned so much throughout the process, and to be able to give it to others now is it means a lot.
Are you going to have any kind of a real or virtual red carpet event for the actual opening?
I don't think those exist in the way that we imagine them in our dreams, but we're excited to be having these conversations with you, Lide, and we look forward to having them over Zoom with many people or who are having the opportunity to watch it around the country. So we're ready to talk anytime.
Sounds great, and I know my listenership, and they will want to get in touch.
Very excited to hear that.
I want to, first of all, congratulate both of you. It's hard enough making a film, let alone a woman-centric film with so many wonderful women behind the scenes. I count when I look at the credits. And to have such a wonderful story, an important story, this well told, is really a boost. We appreciate it, those of us who've been fighting against nuclear, because you are going to be adding to our clarity and our understanding of our own history. And for today, I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby.
Thank you.
That was producer-director Lydia Dean Pilcher and writer-director Ginny Moeller of the film Radium Girls. The producers have graciously earmarked $2 from every ticket sold through Nuclear Hot Seat as a donation to support the program. So we will have a link up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 487, where you can purchase tickets for digital access to the film. They also make that same offer to anti-nuclear groups around the country. So you can contact them, put a link on your website, and they will donate $2 per ticket to your group as well. In addition to this being a painless way to raise some money for your cause, know that I found this film engrossing, well done, and I think you will enjoy it. Again, Radium Girls becomes available as of Friday, October 23rd, 2020.
Activists, shout out.
Two more members of the Kings Bay Plowshare 7 have been sentenced in court. These seven are a group of Catholic peace activists who entered the Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base in Georgia in 2018, armed with hammers, crime scene tape, baby bottles containing their own blood, and an indictment charging the U.S. government with crimes against peace. The base is home to at least 6 nuclear ballistic missile submarines, each of which carries 20 Trident thermonuclear weapons. And each of those weapons is magnitudes of power greater than the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Father Stephen Kelly was sentenced to 33 months in prison for his part in the disarmament action and ordered to participate in the restitution of $33,503.51 of quote-unquote damage to the base. Fortunately, he has already served 30 months, so he only has 3 months to go. Patrick O'Neill, a Catholic worker, husband, father of 8, and grandfather of 2, was sentenced to 14 months in prison, with no credit given for time served. I interviewed Patrick O'Neill for Nuclear Hot Seat number 401. It was from February 18, 2020. And if you wish, you can learn more about the case by listening to our conversation there. 81-year-old co-defendant Elizabeth McAllister received a sentence of time served earlier this year. That means there are 4 co-defendants left to be sentenced before the end of the year. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, October 20th, 2020. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, Beyond Nuclear, the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, neis.org, Public Watchdogs, TaosNews.com, TheGuardian.com, TampaBay.com, DemocracyNow.org, Nuclear Resistor, Kings Bay Plowshares, StLouisTribune.com, WashingtonExaminer.com, APNews.com, Barron's.com, BeltMag.com, Energy.gov, SputnikNews.com, CBSNews.com, NPR, Telegraph.co.uk, KoreaHerald.com, Reuters.com, Rabble.ca, and the ever-co-opted Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Hey, thanks to all of you for listening. And if you want to make sure that you never miss a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat, you can go to our website, nuclearhotseat.com, and sign up to get 1 email a week. I swear, I don't bug you with this. It's just 1 a week that has the link to that week's show as soon as it posts, along with a brief explanation of what is in it. That's nuclearhotseat.com. Scroll down to the yellow opt-in box, put in your first name, put in an email address. You'll get it every time. Now, we rely on our listeners to know what's going on in your neck of the woods nuclear-wise. So if you have a hot tip, a story lead, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And if you appreciate weekly, verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment and when you're on the website, click on the big red button and know that anything you can do to help us will be greatly appreciated. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2020, Libby Halevy and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevy of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that when it comes to nuclear, not only what you don't know can hurt you, chances are it already has. That's it. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.